Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
As we gear up for the Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, we can expect to see a lot of those inspirational mini-documentaries about members of the U.S. team. You know the ones. A lot of stirring music and slow-motion video of our best athletes driven from the earliest ages to pursue their Olympic dreams. I've always found these biographical snapshots inspiring and also intimidating, because the inherent message is that no champion can have a normal childhood. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There have been exceptions. Mogul skier Hannah Kearney's parents told her she would need to find her own sponsors if she wanted to travel to compete. Distance runner Andrew Weeding didn't start running competitively until his senior year in high school. And ski jumpers Mike Holland and Jeff Hastings didn't specialize early. They both played multiple sports as kids. What is most remarkable about all those Olympians? They all grew up in the very same small Vermont town, population 3,000 and something, that since 1984 has sent at least one of its own to all but one Winter Olympics. When Karen Krause, a sports writer at the New York Times, heard about this place, she realized she had to understand what makes it so special. Her new book is called Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town, Secret to Happiness and Excellence. And she joins us this hour from the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix to talk about it. Karen, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Chris. I'm just so excited to talk about this book.
Well, you first heard about Norwich 4 years ago when you were covering the Olympics in Sochi. And ultimately, you say Norwich helped restore your faith in the Olympics. Why had your time in Sochi brought you down?
So those Sochi games cost $51 billion to hold. And you had the feeling that you were all, everyone there, we were all just performers in Vladimir Putin's grand performance, you know, that we were all stagecraft. And you also had this distinct impression that as soon as the last event concluded, all of these facilities would become very costly white elephants. And as I sat there were so many human rights abuses, people dislocated from their homes to make way for these facilities. And I just felt as if the Olympics had gotten so far from its original intent, which was more of a purity of purpose, a bringing together of countries in a friendly manner. It felt as if money had just corrupted the endeavor, maybe irrevocably. So with that, in that environment, I receive a reader email out of the blue saying, I see you're in Sochi covering the Olympics. You might want to check out Hannah Kearney, the mogul skier. She comes from this town in Vermont that has put a lot of Olympians on U.S. teams. And that really intrigued me. And I was assigned hockey for the New York Times, so I wasn't able to meet Hannah. But I tucked that idea away. And when I got home, I started doing research. And that was the beginning.
I have to tell you, before I picked this book up, I assumed Norwich was the home of some kind of coaching compound, right? Like
yes.
The kind that elite gymnasts move to in order to train full time. But the athletes who've come out of this place are kids who happen to grow up there. They live with their families. What is the town like?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I actually set out thinking that I was writing a sports book with an Olympic theme, and what I came away with was a parenting guide. Hmm. And what I found in this town, which looks like something straight out of a Christmas card picture, is parents that are not wholly invested in their children's activities. And that's not to say they're apathetic or lackadaisical. They're supportive. They're willing to ride shotgun and let their children be behind the wheel in this journey, and let their children set the tone for the journey. And I think that's super important, because what I've seen, beginning from the age of 9 when I started competitive swimming through today, is increasingly a lot of parents who are mostly well-intentioned. I mean, no parent sets out to crush the dreams and aspirations and enjoyment of their child has for an activity, but they have seen sports as some zero-sum game where there are just a few carrots at the finish line dangling and only a few are going to get them. So it becomes this zero-sum game where your neighbor's child's victory is your child's defeat. And that's not my sense of what sports is at all. And again, Chris, I'm not only talking the talk, I've walked the walk. So I swam from the age of 9 through college, never made a nationals, never made an Olympic team, did not get a scholarship. I was a walk-on at USC. And I look at how people view sports now, youth sports, as if, you know, all these carrots are the ultimate prize. And it creates an environment in where there are so many fewer winners than losers. And that's just not my experience at all. There were so many intrinsic benefits that I derived from my swimming career. Most of the friends that I have to this day are people I met through swimming. So it helped me develop enduring friendships. I learned life lessons that have helped me immeasurably in my working career. Just things like goal setting, perseverance, resilience, just having the ability to take direction, although maybe sometimes my editors would disagree with that, but just all of these life lessons, you know, dedication and discipline that have served me so well. And also just I have a lifelong love of physical activity. I still swim for fitness and, you know, kind of a mental release to this day. So all of those things I wouldn't give up for any championship or award. And yet I see this message being conveyed, however subtly, that second place is the first loser and that it's all about getting that college scholarship or that pro career or that Olympic berth. And frankly, it's like expecting your child to win the lottery, because these awards, these tangible awards, are far and few between.
Is that really an expression? Second place is the first loser?
That was actually a marketing campaign around the 1996 Olympics for a certain apparel company whose name shall go unspoken.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was mortified because, again, I guess that would make me an abject failure in my sports career. And I could not more fiercely refute that notion.
You know, it's interesting, Karen, because when we talk about the value of sports for our kids, or if we don't have kids, for just this generation of youth, we talk about all the things that you just mentioned until our kid starts winning and then that all
right.
goes out the door.
And I get it. I think that, believe me, I know it's tough to be a parent today, probably tougher than ever. And I absolutely believe that no parent sets out to crush their child's enthusiasm for an activity. But I think what happens is if the child experiences early success, the parent does tend to get more invested in it. But also, in the parent's defense, since the money really came into the Olympic realm when athletes were allowed to compete as pros, and when broadcasting the games became really big business, when the first Olympian, Betsy Snite from Norwich, competed in 1956 and 60, in 1960, it was the first time the Winter Olympics were shown live, and I believe it was fewer than 20 hours of total coverage. So contrast that with the wall-to-wall coverage, and you begin to see how this has become big business. And so what has happened is it's created this cottage industry where you have people wanting to monetize this at the youth level. So they want to almost prey on the parents' desire to do the best they can by their child, or their insecurities that they're not doing enough for their child. And so you have these private coaches sprouting everywhere. You have these traveling teams and all of this stuff. They're not necessarily looking out for the best interests of the children. They're trying to make money. You have these towns that have sprung up and created these massive athletic facilities almost to create a tourist industry where people will come for big sporting events. And it's all a little crazy. And I'm worried that the child is being lost in the shuffle.
All right, Karen, for a long time, Norwich, Vermont was an old school farming community. What remains of those agrarian roots in terms of the way Norwich parents view childhood and the culture of the town imagines childhood?
Well, so in Vermont, they're very proud of the fact that they the farms that remain are organic farms. They're not trying to supersize their crops or their cows. And I think that's how the parents approach the development of their children. They're not trying to make them more than they can be. They're not trying to accelerate their development. Also, when you come from an agrarian culture, it really is survival of everyone. You know, everyone has to help one another out for everyone to survive and thrive. And so that communitarian spirit has outlasted really the farming culture, because now the community is made up, not mostly, but does have a lot of Dartmouth professors, people who work at the teaching hospital connected with the college. But somehow those communitarian values that took root a long time ago have remained strong. It's just, I guess, Chris, I really, even before I stepped foot in Vermont, I really had an understanding of this town and a connection to it, because I grew up in Santa Clara, California in the 1970s. And however odd this may sound when you look at what Santa Clara has become due to the technological revolution that transformed it and remade it into Silicon Valley, when I was growing up, there were plum and apricot orchards all around my home. We were still considered the fruit basket of the United States. So I understood this communitarian spirit because I lived it as a child. And I also understood how one or two extraordinary performers can create and feed not a frenzy, but an enthusiasm that attracts everybody to these sports, because Santa Clara at the time that I was growing up was the swimming capital, not only in the United States, but in the world. So that's how I became a swimmer. I mean, obviously I was not going to become a ski jumper growing up in Santa Clara. And so I understood how Jeff Hastings and Mike Holland having success could feed the enthusiasm of others and create a culture that where people almost looked at the Olympics as something that was normalized, like, oh, yeah, I'll go to the Olympics, just like, yeah, I'll go to college. Hmm. It was really funny. I talked to a 9-year-old boy who told me that he was under the impression that the way you make the Olympics is each town gets to send one person to represent the United States. And I thought that was so cute, because of course he would look at it that way. Why would he not?
My guest is Karen Krause. She's a sports writer on staff at the New York Times and author of a new book called Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. You can join this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with New York Times sports writer Karen Kraus, author of the book Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Ironically, Karen, the first Olympian to come out of Norwich has a story that sounds much more like the approach that today's families take to cultivating young athletes.
Absolutely. And it really served as the cautionary tale. Betsy Snight was the first Olympian. She was an alpine skier. And her father, Al, was as ferocious and involved a parent as you will ever find in the youth sports scene. He steered Betsy and her kid sister, Sunny, who was 4 years younger, into the sport. He was their primary coach. He found people from Dartmouth who could help them with their conditioning. And remember, this was the 1950s when there were only a few hundred girls in competitive skiing in the United States altogether. He was so far ahead of the curve in his, shall we say, enthusiasm for developing championship sports daughters, and he would take them out of school in the winter so that they could go all over the United States to train and compete, or he had the money to send them abroad. And Betsy, it appeared that she did okay short term. I mean, she won a silver medal in Squaw Valley, but she had sort of a wiring much like her father, where she was competitive, as was he, and she also really liked the attention. Her sister Sunny, on the other hand, would have much rather been on a horse than on skis. She was not wired that way. She would have preferred the camaraderie of some kind of activity. She would have much rather been in a team sport. And so she really struggled. She was also in the mix for the Olympic team in 1960 at the age of 15. They had a 10-member women's national team from which they selected the 6-member Olympic team. And a month before that selection was finalized, she had a practice crash and never competed again. Both the sisters had unhappy adult lives. They lived unhappily ever after. And I wish I could tell you that this is an anomaly or an aberration, but in my 30 plus years of chronicling sports, I've seen it all too often when kids are raised as performers first and foremost. That's how they're rewarded for their results and how well they do. Their identities are built around their performance. The person piece is given short shrift. You really do see a lot of them struggling in their post-sports lives, trying to figure out, like, who am I without, once I've shed this sport, like, who am I? How do I matter? What am I worth? What is my self-worth? I've seen a lot of anxiety and depression result from these struggles. And it starts with the most successful. I did a story last September on Michael Phelps, 28-time Olympic medalist. He said that he has struggled mightily with anxiety and depression, and at times has even had suicidal thoughts. And he was telling me about the challenges of being successful at a young age. He made his first Olympic team at 15, and he said, imagine from the time you are 15 on, you are never able to make a first impression on anybody you meet, because when you meet them, they already think they know everything about you. They've already developed an idea of who you are, what you stand for. And it's almost as if the narrative of your personality and life has been hijacked. He also said that even such a small developmental skill as learning how to interact with strangers and make small talk, he never really had to develop that like the rest of us do, because from a young age, people would come up to him and make all of the effort. And all he had to do was be sort of a passive participant in the conversation. And so you can see where it's really dangerous if you are drumming into these children that it's all about performance, 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 results, results, results. And I think that's where I really found comfort and solace in the Norwich parents, because they really are trying to connect their children to the community, to nature, give them a lasting love of physical activity, help them develop life lessons that they will carry forward, help them develop responsibility and a feeling of competence and a self of self-autonomy and a resilience and all of these things that you really need to exist in the world.
So I think we've said that as of the writing of this book, Norwich had had 11 Olympic athletes so far. It was very nearly 12. Kevin Pierce almost certainly would have competed. Then he suffered a terrible accident. And his is an interesting story of finding a life after sports because you had a life before sports.
Exactly. You put it perfectly. I could not have said it better. And it's interesting, your listeners, when they watch Shaun White, who is competing in this Olympics, it's crazy to think that back in 2010, in the lead up to those games, Kevin Pierce was considered the main challenger to Shaun. He had actually defeated Shaun a couple times in the lead up to those games. And that was akin to someone beating Michael Phelps in the lead up to his Summer Olympics appearances, because Shaun has been that dominant a figure in snowboarding. And less than 2 months before the start of the Vancouver Games, during a practice session before one of the last series of competitions on which the Olympic team would be finalized, Kevin suffered a catastrophic head injury when he in a crash. And he says it's only because of all of the freedom and the independence and resilience he had developed as a result of his parents having given him the ability to take risks and to pursue his passion, that he was able to sort of get beyond what this could have been just a life-defining event. There was a moment or a time where it wasn't really, no one was sure whether he would survive. And what has happened, Chris, is that he has been able to reinvent himself. He has been able to show the same resilience in his life that he did in sports. He started loveyourbrain.org, a foundation that serves as a support group for fellow survivors of traumatic brain injury and for their caregivers. And he really gave, before he started this, these people didn't really have anywhere to go or any safety net or support system. And so he's provided that. And he was the first to acknowledge that he thinks he's actually making more of a difference and is a better person now than he was as a champion athlete, that he's making more of a difference in this part of his, in this act of his life, if you will, than he ever did as a champion athlete. And I just think it's interesting because people who see sports in that very narrow bubble of, you know, you either become rich and famous or you are a failure, will look at Kevin's story as the great tragedy. Here was a person who in another, if things had unfolded differently, might still be competing with Sean and challenging Sean for supremacy, or maybe by now have overtaken Sean for supremacy. And oh, but now he's fallen off the face of the sports earth. And oh, how sad it was. When if you read the chapter, you can't help getting to the end and feeling as if this is perhaps the most triumphant story of them all. And again, it's because there's so many intangibles that enter the picture in sports that I feel are not talked about enough, and that Kevin's story embodies.
Back to that conversation you had with Michael Phelps, which sounds quite candid. Did you go so far as to ask him if he would trade all of his Olympic glory to have not suffered from anxiety and depression in a sense that he wasn't very adept at you know, social skills?
Well, he has a great attitude, and this is the athlete's attitude, is you never look back, you just look forward, you never think what if, you just keep moving forward. And he's been able to frame it in such a beautiful way. He says, you know, because I had all of this success, it has given me the biggest platform possible to talk about this piece of athletics and to talk about how it is okay to be perfectly imperfect, and that even the strongest athletes and the most successful people can suffer from these illnesses and are vulnerable. And so he thinks because of what he did in the pool, he has a bigger platform and a bigger megaphone, if you will, to reach as many people as he can who need to hear his message. And I give him so much credit for talking about this, because it is sort of drummed into athletes at a very young age that you just fight through everything. Grit. You need to just keep going, keep moving, compartmentalize pain. Don't talk about vulnerability. Vulnerability is weakness. And imagine someone you really look up to, and you hear that person owning up to these vulnerabilities and insecurities and really deep, dark issues. He's doing a world of good and sort of peeling back the fairy tale and really showing what is the reality.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times sports writer Karen Krause, whose new book is called Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. You can join us at 800-933-5372. It's really interesting that Hannah Carney is very grateful today for the experience of her mom putting her on no-cut soccer teams, which is to say the kind of soccer team somebody like me would have played on as well, even when it was apparent she was a really good athlete.
Yes, and I didn't realize until I started researching this book that no-cut leagues are becoming very rare, and that's a shame. And Hannah brought up a piece of it that I hadn't really considered, that whether there were cuts or not, she was always going to be on these teams. She was one of the best athletes in whatever sport she tried. But the value of these no-cut leagues for her was that it gave her access and to these girls that she might not otherwise have ever met. Girls who were not that athletically inclined, who were in the sport for the camaraderie and the friendships, and were not nearly as proficient as she was. So she learned two things from them. A, she saw how hard they worked and gained a better appreciation for the gifts that she has, and also made her maybe work harder, because, wow, if they can work that hard and they're not seemingly getting the tangible benefits from it, that what's to, you know, I need to work just as hard as them. But beyond that, it gave her her social circle. So these girls grew up to become her best friends. And because they grew up to be non-elite athletes, they were able to time and again give her this perspective that she wasn't necessarily getting from the insular world of freestyle skiing. So when she was really getting down on herself when she got second instead of first, or failed to make the finals, or all of these things that seem like terrible failures, they were able to step in and say, "Hannah, please, you're, you know, one of the best people in the world at what you do. How many of us can say that? And, you know, we support you because we see how hard you work, and that we love you no matter what. And when you come home, let's go to dinner." And so they were always drawing her out from that kind of bubble that might have just consumed her otherwise. And she said, "My goodness, I don't know where I would be without these girls that I never would have known if there had been cuts on these teams, because they would probably not have made it."
You're right about the coaches in Norwich thinking of themselves more as educators than kingmakers.
Right. And Hannah's mom is the longtime recreation league director, and she said she invariably will have to have a conversation with a new coach who comes in and maybe doesn't play everyone, or they go to a game where, or a tournament where there are teams from other areas, and they maybe are much more intense in their approach. And so that coach maybe gets drawn into that and doesn't play anyone, and she'll have to sit the person down and say, "Look, that's not our philosophy. So if that's your philosophy, maybe this isn't a good fit." And I think it starts with the Olympians themselves. So many of the Olympians still live in the town, and they model the people that everyone else hopes their children become.
My guest is New York Times sports writer Karen Krause. We're talking about her book, Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. If you want to join us, you can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Karen Krause. She's a sports writer on staff at the New York Times, and she's just published a new book called Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. Join us on Twitter @KERAThink or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I loved reading about Mike Holland and Jeff Hastings, the ski jumpers. First of all, what was their relationship to one another growing up?
So Mike was a few years younger than Jeff and really looked up to him. And so Jeff is the reason Mike got into ski jumping. He preferred cross-country skiing. And when he was 10, one day, Jeff just knocked on the front door of the Holland house. And when Mike answered, Jeff said, "Here, I have a pair of old ski jumping skis. You're coming jumping with me today." And Mike said he was terrified, but he didn't want to let Jeff down because this is someone to whom he looked up. So he accompanied him to a hill that was on the property of an artist. They called it Paul Sample Hill after the artist on whose property it sat. And it took him 10 minutes, he said, to get the nerve up to go down this hill. He was just frightened the whole way. And when he reached the bottom, he thought, oh, that's so fun. I want to do that again, which of course shows that these people are definitely wired differently than the rest of us. But that was the beginning. And then it turned out that through Mike and Jeff and their unbridled enthusiasm and passion for this sport, they infected their brothers who became Olympians, all of the kids. They created really this snowball of activity in this sport in this town. And to this day, they continue to volunteer their time to coach and teach ski jumping. If you go to a Hanover High ski jumping competition or meet, you will see Jeff Hastings, who, mind you, is the most successful U.S.-born Olympic ski jumper. He finished fourth on the Big Hill in 1984. No one has done better than that since. He will be doing the public address announcing. And Mike Holland, who set a world flying record in 1984, he will be at the bottom of the hill grooming it. So imagine you're a teenager and these people are among the most successful ever in our country and your sport, and they are just doing this grunt work to make your meet run more smoothly and more professionally. How can you not be A, inspired, but also humbled, and also see in no uncertain terms that these people do not see themselves as better or more entitled than anyone else. They are very much in the community and not just of the community.
You alluded earlier to the fact that the population of Norwich now is headed by some households that, you know, have one or both parents who are physicians or who work at Dartmouth. That's the kind of place we typically associate with really heavy pressure to excel academically in high school in order to go to the best possible college. Norwich Right. kids are actually discouraged from loading up too heavily on AP classes.
Yeah, and I think that I'm glad you brought up that piece of it, because I think there's this misconception that if you come from an affluent area that a lot of the ills are just not in your path and you can circumvent them, when I have found the opposite to be the case. And I talked to some social scientists when I was researching this book, that when you have the wealthier towns, what tends to happen is the parents became successful by having this type A personality, which they sort of pass on, even if it's just by osmosis, to their children. So that creates the expectations and the pressure. Then you have a lot of people living behind gated communities, or they have people who can do a lot of their daily chores, so they're not really in and about the community. They're not having personal interaction with a lot of their neighbors in a given day. And then you have the piece of it where they'll send their children to private coaches, and they will have them on these traveling teams that are very costly, but that will preclude them from participating on their high school teams, or they will send them to academies where they the children are just only with other highly competitive children, and they're getting the competitive piece of it, but not necessarily the communitarian piece of it. And so this does lead to elevated levels of anxiety and depression, because what is being lost is this large social safety net that can lift you up when you fall or fail. And the Hannah Carney chapter is a wonderful example of that. She was as hard on herself as anyone possibly could be. She's a perfectionist. She had very high expectations and would really get down on herself when she didn't meet them. But the community was almost served as her collective therapist. The townspeople would time and again lift her up when she was feeling down and remind her of the bigger piece of sports and say, you know, we support you unconditionally. We are so proud of you and what you are doing and how you are representing this town. And she told me that as a result, she was able to get over disappointments much more quickly than she otherwise would have. And if lest you think that this is just typical, I told this story to a multiple medalist in swimming, and she said, wow, that is really a special place. And then she told me this story that she had a summer before an Olympics where she was really struggling. And she, that holiday season toward Christmas, was out and about with her father and happened upon the parent of a woman she had competed against. And the man said, hello, really good to see you. And I just want you to know that we are really praying for you that you will be able to turn things around before the Olympics. And she could feel her father tensing up because really this is sort of a double-edged compliment, or, you know, with support like that, really, who needs criticism? And when the man walked away, this swimmer turned to her father and said, wow, like, how am I supposed to process that? I mean, I think he meant it as support and a compliment, but it doesn't really feel that way. It feels as if I've somehow been a disappointment. And when I told Hannah that story, she was equally agog, like, oh my gosh, I have never had that happen.
Hannah's parents also said, look, we are really supportive of you, but we're not going to put our entire family's finances at risk for your sports career.
Jill said she didn't even know there were people who did that because, of course, that's not the Norwich way. Yes, and that's, again, you know, people look at this Vermont town, it's fairly affluent, and so they think, well, of course these people have success. They have access to all the best equipment, coaching, resources, right? But Hannah was not like that at all, and she was their most successful Olympian with two medals. When she was 12 or 13 and had kind of outgrown local competition, her parents sat her down and said, you know, if you need to get to these regional and national events, we can't afford the airfare and the hotels. And so you're going to have to find a way to raise some money. And we're not going to do it for you. We will support you 100%, but you need to figure it out for yourself. And so Hannah did. She wrote up a resume and went biking across town and did find some businesses who sponsored her. But what she also found that proved more valuable in the long run was this father of a townsperson who was a self-made millionaire, and he agreed to finance Hannah until she made a U.S. national team. And these were his two stipulations. He wanted a copy of her report card each term, and he wanted an itemized budget of how she spent the money. And she said that looking back, he was teaching her these super valuable life lessons with these two stipulations. A, that education was more important than any results that she had in her sport. Like she said, that developing her brain was more important than anything she did in freestyle skiing. And also, he was teaching her the value of a dollar. You know, you hear parents tell their children, well, money doesn't grow on trees. At 12 or 13, she was just seeing how pricey things can be and learning to try to find the best deals on flights and hotels and whatnot. And she said that the lesson proved invaluable for her moving forward. And, you know, she never did meet this man. So he wasn't doing this for his own, you know, ego gratification, to get some kind of attention or notice out of it.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. From what I know about the philosophy that surrounds most young elite athletes in America today, Karen, they're expected to start very early, train very intensively, and specialize early on. Once again, this is not the norm in Norwich.
Right. So one of the Olympians, the alpine skier Felix McGrath, he was a four time varsity athlete in high school, or a four sport varsity athlete in high school. So all of these Olympians, with the exception of Betsy Snite, competed in multiple sports through high school. And in fact, Julia Crass, who is a slope style skier who just missed this year's Olympic team, she was on the 2014 squad when her sport made its Olympic medal debut. She's now a sophomore at Dartmouth. She actually came back from the 2014 Olympics, where she did quite well. She acquitted herself beautifully. And her coaches in the fall of that year said, well, now you need to go to a conditioning camp in New Zealand or South America with the rest of us. And she said, no way. I have a state championship to win in soccer. Hmm. And so she stiff-armed her coaches, who were very myopic on the skiing piece, and she captained her soccer team as a senior to the state title. So again, it's this belief that, you know, I'm not going to listen to that, because I'm going to push back, because I've seen the people who came before me have success doing it this way. And so I'm not going to alter my philosophy to fit this very narrow mold. And, you know, you don't need to move to Norwich to replicate this model. You all have an example of that in Dallas, in the golfer Jordan Spieth, whose career I've chronicled as the golf writer at the Times. He competed in multiple sports. He was a baseball player. He was a basketball player. And before he decided at 12 or 13 to concentrate on golf. And he credits those other sports with helping him develop just spatial awareness and certain intangible aspects of sports and athletics that have helped him in the golfing piece. And I have heard him speak at several youth clinics about how important it is to not specialize young. And he, again, is not just someone who's talking the talk, he walked the walk. He also has the communitarian piece of it. He's got his foundation. He works with First Tee of Dallas. He does a lot with Special Olympics because of his sister Ellie's involvement in that. So I think Jordan is someone who could be made an honorary resident of Norwich.
Karen Krause is a sports writer. She's on staff at the New York Times, and she's got a new book out. It's called Norwich, One Tiny Vermont Town's Secret to Happiness and Excellence. Karen, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you find podcasts. You can subscribe to the podcast also at think.kera.org, where you'll find more information about the show. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.